Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Flip Table Theology. I am your host, one of your hosts, Christy Love. I am here today with only two of my co-hosts. We've got a smaller table today. Holly Madden's joining me and Sharita Thomas Tate. We are going to be having a hard conversation. I'm sure probably a little bit of a triggering conversation for us and for some of our listeners around deconstructing the theology of suffering. And so I want to talk about kind of a baseline to start with. So I'm going to ask the question, Sharita and Holly, what did you grow up in the church being taught about suffering? What were some of the beliefs and the perspectives from scripture and just like Christian culture that you absorbed personally that kind of shaped your initial views about suffering in your life? Either one of you want to go first?
Yeah, I'll start. I think that my perspective was shaped by the idea that Christ died and suffered for us, which was the central theme of all spiritual beliefs and practices in my faith tradition growing up. And because of that suffering, we were called to suffer with Christ. Like, suffering is a part of your faith journey. You suffer because Christ suffered. And it's the ultimate, like, not just sacrifice, but it's the ultimate connection to God, is that you're willing to suffer for yourself and for other and others and for the greater good.
So almost like a glorification of
absolutely,
suffering.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. How about you, Holly?
I would relate to that a lot. I think I also was taught a lot of the humility in suffering, as like, you don't talk about it, you don't, you know, you, and almost a perspective, a very dismissive perspective of like, consider your privilege, people have it worse, and those kind of things. And like, it's sinful to boast about things that you're going through. And so there was a lot of, it taught a lot of dismissive, even though it was like taught from a perspective of like humility and character growth or whatever it was. It felt very much like you don't talk about it, you deal with it. And then as you start to heal from it, it's just like this quiet experience instead of it being super community focused.
Can I say though that there was also this dichotomy of those who had certain kinds of suffering were somehow outside of God's will. So, you know, if you were in poverty, for example, you're suffering in your poverty because you have some sin that you haven't, you know, surrendered to God. Or if, you know, certain health conditions were a result of your doing and you have sin is why you're suffering because of that. There was this dichotomy both of suffering is good, and suffering also is a reflection of your spiritual life.
Health. Yeah. Like, if you couldn't explain it with a spiritual purpose, or if it had some kind of roots in what would be considered sinful behavior or behavior not upholding Christian ethics, then we're going to blame the suffering on the sin.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, a kind of that, a whole phenomenology of trying to explain a phenomenon. Why does something happen?
Yeah.
And you do whatever you can to make it make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And Holly, going back to what you said too, I think that silence of suffering that's often encouraged in a lot of fundamental conservative evangelical spaces is only for a season. Because when you get through the suffering, right, there's this, like, this is now my testimony
piece.
And so, like, now that I'm through the suffering and I have my quote-unquote happy ending or whatever, right, like, I have my mountaintop moment, now I'm obliged to share my suffering in the light of victory and triumph. But there's, like, this disconnect that I've always noticed of, we always seem to talk about suffering in hindsight, from the perspective of, I've overcome, I'm victorious, and we don't celebrate the narrative of the struggle because we silence that part.
I think that is true in some perspectives, but I think of the perspective of maybe like a liberation theology, one that sees the gospel as the hope for freedom, the hope for being released from suffering, because you have been born into a state of suffering, or you live in a state of suffering, or something about your being creates suffering for you, that the Bible and the gospel provides a lens for being released from that. And so it's not in hindsight, in that case, in my perspective. It is a forward thinking of, this is what I'm aiming for. Mm-hmm. Because you are in perhaps a constant state of suffering. You were born into a state of suffering. Mm-hmm. You know, something about your being has created a world where you are created in a suffering space.
Mm-hmm. But I would argue that that liberation perspective is probably more of a deconstructed view of suffering.
Yeah, perhaps. I think of it more, though, like in the Black church perspective. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily one that is deconstructed, but one that has been given to us. We've been given this gospel and have received this gospel, and but it makes sense for us in the space of, I can be set free.
Yeah.
You know?
Do you think that's more of a generational and like a cultural, like, almost like holistic perspective on suffering versus like individual stories of suffering?
I think that it is definitely a cultural view of suffering, and particularly for groups who have experienced great suffering.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. And I think that's important to acknowledge in this conversation, that there is our individual theologies with suffering and like how that impacts our day-to-day struggles and things that we go through. But there is that we are all part of a greater collective, and those collective kind of community-based narratives around suffering, especially for marginalized groups, I think are really important to name, and like how they impact people either in a compounded way or sometimes even as a separate way.
Yeah, I like what you're saying here. I like the idea, yes, there's this cultural perspective, and we're taught that perspective, and it serves a great purpose for us as a collective. Individually, though, I think it does damage for us when we are expected to live in this space of suffering because yes. of some greater good.
Yes, that I 100% agree with, because you're right. I think there is this collective narrative that's really important to name, but when we internalize that kind of perspective of the overcoming, you know, cooperative narrative, and we internalize that to our individual perspectives, sometimes we feel like, well, we just have to deal with this. Mm-hmm. We just have to go through mm-hmm. this. We have to get to the other side. Mm-hmm. We have to get to the mountaintop. I'm going to be silent about my struggle until I've got my story or my testimony, or, mm-hmm. you know, I've maybe there's something wrong with me and I don't want to draw attention to that from a spiritual perspective.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's where things get really complicated.
Yeah. It's muddy.
It is muddy. So for me personally, I understand both of your individual perspectives. I would add a little bit. I relate to both of them. But I think for me, I grew up in a very Midwestern, relatively privileged faith space that was very insulated, and insulated even from struggles in some respects, at least at the beginning of my life. I always kind of reflect and say, like, I don't really remember a lot of struggle until I was in middle school and my parents' marriage fell apart. And like at that point, I remember struggle kind of being introduced into my life in different forms and capacities. But I remember hearing so many of those Christian catchphrases that we've called out on this podcast for, you know, a year now, you know, but a lot of the toxic additions to the gospel, like God's never going to give you more than you can handle. You know, we roll our eyes immediately around the table. But like those kind of statements, it took me a very long time into early adulthood before I really understood that those were not biblical, because they were always said in the same breath and with the same weight and the same importance as scriptural statements about suffering. And so it always felt like suffering was something that you should be able to handle. Mm-hmm. You should be able to be tough enough to deal with what you're given, mm-hmm. and that what you're given is almost assigned to you based upon your capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember hearing a youth pastor talking about a conversation about suffering, and I remember he quoted in Isaiah, where he talked about, and kind of his paraphrase was, God reserves the hardest battles for the strongest soldiers, kind of thing.
I've heard that.
And I just remember him like going on and on about like building up your strength and being strong to handle things. And so for me, like when I look at my core wound as like an Enneagram one, you know, that core wound is like this need to constantly perform and to be okay and, you know, to take care of things and to solve problems and to be strong. And I think a lot of that comes from that Christian culture of suffering that I was raised with that says, you just got to figure it out. You just got to be strong enough. God believes in you, so you should be able to get through this. And in hindsight, I have had to unpackage. In hindsight, I've had to unpackage just how toxic that is and how impactful that's been for me and all the ways that it still negatively impacts me, even though I've deconstructed from it.
Yeah, that really makes me think of, follow me, I'm going to go on like a rabbit trail here, and it's maybe and it's ADHD related. But it makes me think that like the individualism of suffering, of like I'm experiencing this thing, and then the connection of that suffering being directly correlated to all things faith, that like removes this degree of control. Like God has given me this suffering, and I am, you know, like whatever like place that I'm in, maybe it's because God trusts me to handle this suffering, or I've experienced this suffering because I'm not praying enough and I'm not having enough faith and I have to like pursue. And like, doesn't that mean that like a lot of this suffering that we, or the perspective around suffering that we were taught in the evangelical world has been, is really just like this huge crisis of disconnection? Because when you think of it, and like so much of our suffering is impacted by the natural world that we live in, and there's so much suffering that we actually have way more control over than we realize. And that's like those pieces of, because I'm thinking of how often we experience something, we try to name it, and we try to I'm really struggling to put with my words here, you guys. I think of like individuals that are living in impoverished countries, like third world countries, that are experiencing so much suffering, like suffering from not being having enough food, not having clean water, things that they do not have access to, that those countries do not have access to, and our countries have access to, and how much there's like a lot of the time the causation of that, like there's climate change, and people that are directly impacted by climate change are those living in the poorest parts of our world, and yet we see that suffering as like, well, they don't believe in God, but the suffering is this disconnection of like, but our first class world countries that are building these factories and oil wells in the ocean that are then poisoning these countries, like there's this direct connection to their suffering that we have some control over. Like, yes, it's going to take a long time to heal our world, but we have control over that. You know, I think of illness too, like here in, like we just were, and part of my like is we're getting over a really horrible stomach bug at my house with my little girl, and like there's so much in the amount of processing in our food, there's so much toxins in our air and our water and all of these things that are making us sick. And I know this is probably a whole other like environmental podcast for a different time, but like there's this direct connection to suffering to our world, and a direct connection between our ability to connect to the world, to one another, to different, and that there's I feel like, I guess what I'm trying to say is I feel like church has like encourage that disconnection by seeing suffering through a lens that it's not.
I would almost say, I don't know that church has encouraged it, but I would say that church has used it to avoid accountability.
Ooh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, if you think about these things, like some of the things that you named, Holly Sharia, you named some things earlier, both of you named poverty, right? And so, like, if we just use that as an example, I think about all of the ways that I have seen scripture and theology twisted to justify the suffering of someone in poverty, to avoid the complicity of the church when it comes to contributing to systems, structures, powers, political dynamics that claim to be pro-life when in reality are pro-birth. And they completely disregard the impact that they have on human life in this country and beyond once any individual is born into this world, what that looks like for infants, and what that looks like for access to healthy nutrition and food deserts and all of these layered complexities. And we hear theology used to justify the pull yourself up by your bootstraps, or, you know, oh, well, you know, if you're suffering, God's not going to give you more than you can handle. When we see faith community after faith community after faith community not stepping up in practical ways to meet needs or to name those things in a public advocacy kind of space that connects faith and those issues.
Yeah, I also would like to name and connect the idea of suffering to love. That God's love was demonstrated through suffering, and that suffering then is connected to his love for us, which would allow us to say, hey, suffering then can be good, it can be spiritual, and, you know, I just think that this connection between how suffering can be an indication of love, that's problematic for me, but it's hard to disconnect from the central themes of Christianity.
Well, and with that, Sharita, I think we could also add a layer of the justification of love and tough love that Christians have often used to justify things like corporal punishment in their homes and in the way that they raise their children, or domestic violence and all of those kind of components as a manifestation of love, that I'm doing these things to you because I love you and because, you know, I want, and it often derives from that exact line of thinking that you're talking about, that, you know, God's love was demonstrated in sending his son to suffer, and because I love you, I'm going to spank you, or I'm going to beat you with an object, or I'm going to tell you to go back to a domestically violent, unsafe environment. And it is a completely twisted representation of God's heart and God's word and God's scripture every single time we hear that.
And I think it does so much damage to us. I can say for at least me, and for many women, and for many persons who have gone through abuse, it is very dangerous kind of theology to take on, because you have this internal belief that you deserve the suffering. You deserve the suffering, and you start to connect. Like, you know, for me, I've always struggled with the idea of God being a good father. He's a good father, but he is going to allow you to suffer, or to cause you to suffer. You know, we even think of like Job, you know, like he brought suffering. He allowed suffering to come unto Job to prove something or another. Like, I don't want to go through suffering in order to prove that I'm a great servant of God. But that is used and taught. And then when we internalize it, it puts us in such danger, in such harm's way.
I feel like that just like perpetuates the generational cycles of abuse, generational cycles of all of these issues, instead of empowering what we learned in the Gospels, which, like, Jesus came to alleviate suffering. Like, you see how often, like, Jesus is talking to a whole group of people and he's talking a lot, so they start to get hungry, so he provides food for them to meet a basic human need of food. Like, there's so many stories in the Bible of healing and comfort and presence and an alleviation of human suffering, alleviation of meeting your needs and things like that. And I think that when you're in that place, that mindset of like, I deserve this suffering, and you're correlating it to abuse, like as a child, like, I deserve to be abused, I deserve to be hurt. Those people grow up to be parents that then overlook things that are happening to their children, or become the people that harm their children, and those horrific cycles that are almost sometimes condoned in the church, instead of recognizing that that is just this incredibly horrific way of survival and way of living. And that like for myself, I'm going to bring up like the suffering of mental illness, because that's a really invisible type of suffering that I feel like a lot of people struggle with. And I've been very upfront and honest about that. Like, I don't want to sit in a place of like, I just have to struggle with it. I just have to struggle with it, because my hope and my prayer is that when my kids get older, if they have some of the genetic components of mental illness or just the impact of the world of mental illness that they're taught, I'm, to be honest, like, I'm not okay, and I'm going to do the things that I can do to help myself. And that is spiritual. That is faith. Like, spirituality is, I'm not okay, so I'm going to go spend time in nature. I'm not okay, so I'm going to invite people over to my house and reach out and ask for help. Like, I'm not okay, so I'm going to go make an appointment with a doctor or a psychiatrist or a therapist or whatever. And like, that be the way that we recognize that suffering is supposed to be handled, instead of glorified, of the sitting and the being quiet about it, and that becoming something that's been a generational curse almost.
So I want to take this two separate ways, and so I'm going to go one way and then we're going to circle back around and incorporate this other way, because I think what you're both saying is so critically important for so many reasons. But the first direction I want to take this is, Holly, kind of where you're heading, is this idea of downplaying trauma, recentering trauma through a spiritual lens, and then using spiritual language to change and kind of like almost just be dismissive with people of what they're facing, what they're going through, and like what that does in each of those situations, what that does to those individuals, how it's dehumanizing.
I just recently had a conversation with my mom about this. We have several family friends and people that we know from the community, mostly from church settings, who have gone through really horrible health battles to the point that several of them have passed away. They kept it a secret. They kept it a secret, not from their families, but from the church community. And I don't really understand it. It harmed their family members who had to hold on to these secrets about their loved ones being sick. And I don't understand if it's a part of them hiding it because they don't want to make it seem like God is not good or God is not able. I don't know what the reasoning is for, but what you're saying though makes me think about that. This idea that, you know, I have a friend whose parent had cancer, and instead of asking for support from their church community, they hid it. They hid it from everyone. And this is a common experience that I've seen. They've hid it from everyone, and they're left with, the family's left with now having to explain, oh, they've suffered a long battle with cancer, and we're all unhealthy now because we've been keeping their secret. We haven't had the support that we needed as caregivers. And it's just such a horrible, vicious cycle that I see play out often. I don't know if this is a Black church thing or not, but it happens a lot.
Well, and I think, Sharita, you're naming like the medical intersection of that. There are so many traumatic intersections that we see every single day in human life and human existence. But I do think that there's something really important to be naming about, like, when we're at an intersection that's causing trauma, and we are afraid to name that in a spiritual space because we don't want someone to either judge us or make assumptions on, like, are we being sinful? Do we have all these things? Like, because of that theological framework that we've already named, but also even the, like, dismissive piece of that and how traumatic that can be when you're truly struggling. You were talking about mental health crisis, Holly, and, like, how many people that we've heard stories of who end up in terrifying places because their intersection with mental health and their lived experience was so isolating because they were afraid to name that in a faith environment. And I think when we, again, it's an issue of accountability for me.
Especially when that faith environment, their response to your mental health issue is just pray more.
Right.
Or, you know, go to church more. Right. You know.
Yes, but that's the solution to everything. And so we hear that when someone has an intersection with a financial crisis or an economic hardship. We see that when someone has had a health intersection or a mental health intersection. We see that when there's relational disruption in people's lives. And, you know, again, pray harder, come to church more, come to this class and these 12 steps on how to do things, and it'll fix all your financial problems. And the fact of the matter is, we struggles so much with what the heart of the church was designed to be, I truly believe, mm-hmm. which is community. Mm-hmm. And like mm-hmm. the community of supporting suffering people and how to do that in a way that's not dismissive mm-hmm. is something that I think the traditional church in our country and around the world mm-hmm. doesn't know how to do.
I feel like so for myself, in my journey of deconstructing and then reconstructing, the thing that has like completely transformed the way that I see the world is literally that piece of like community, or I'm going to use the word relationships, like how interconnected we all are and how much we need each other. And I think that there was so much harm in this idea of like, you just need God, instead of recognizing like we need each other, we need our earth, we need the environment that we live in. And I think of how when we, oh my gosh, my thoughts are so distracted today. But I think of what you were talking about, Sharita, like when we experience suffering and we experience trauma, it is literally manifest as like energy inside of our body and trapped energy. That's how you have, that's how you experience traumas. It's energy that can't release. We can't run, fright. Yeah. And it's trapped. And I think of how much like the healing comes when there's that outlet of getting mm-hmm. that energy out, and healing can look like a whole bunch of different things. Like I have really, you know, grabbed on to this healing that happens through movement and how much that has like helped me heal from trauma that happened to me as a child, like and recently, like being able to like heal it that way. I also think of how healing it is to talk about things, but how much more healing it is to talk about it in a space where there is connection and there is validation for emotion. There is sometimes challenges, but it's done in this very loving, supportive manner and in a way that is held. And like you were talking about like the testimony side of it. And like when someone hides their suffering, we're storytellers. Like that's healing. That's how we've survived for generations. But my story is also your story. Like I have experiences of walking through life with both of you, and like our stories are going to intersect. And there are times that like someone goes through something and it impacts us. Like trauma can even, after 9/11, so many children, so many individuals across our nation were diagnosed with PTSD from watching, mm-hmm. from feeling that fear, from feeling that trauma. And so like you don't have to be even sitting at someone's bedside to feel that suffering and to have an experience of that. Absolutely. And so much healing happens when we talk about it, when we share our stories, when we share the stories with each other as it's happening. And so there's this piece of suffering that like we're denying healing in people when it's being encouraged to be private and hidden, instead of recognizing that we heal together in community, we heal together in relationship.
I think part of it is ego. Mm-hmm. And particularly as church leaders, I think church leaders have an ego that says you can't experience suffering. You help heal suffering. Mm-hmm. We're there to support other suffering. So you have to deny your suffering so that you can help heal other suffering.
That's a whole nother podcast. But I agree with you 100%.
And I think they are then also modeling that for others to also deny their own suffering.
Yeah, 100%. So like, Holly, as you're talking, I caught myself being super triggered from like hearing old evangelical voices in the soundtrack that are just built into that, and like having to remind myself, no, like that's not right. And I heard myself like, no, but we're not supposed to live in a spirit of fear, right? We're not. God gives us all of these fear nots in the Bible and like all those cheesy sayings. But I think acknowledging that fear is not a lack of faith. Fear is a normal trauma response, and it is associated with anxiety. And
like when Jesus said, fear not, when angels said, fear not, it was done in a presence of, this is like something that I'm like crazy passionate about. It was somebody coming to say like, I'm here to comfort you. I'm here to help you, not like shame you for being afraid, right. But like here in relationship, let me come and give you assistance or presence, right. Or be with you. And like, yeah, right. That's a thing.
But that's exactly it. That is a thing, because we're not met in highly evangelical spaces a lot of times with, let me suffer with you. Let me have empathy with you. You've talked in the past about Brené Brown's example of like crawling down into the hole with somebody, mm-hmm. and like instead, we just push people into these very isolating spaces because we've not been taught how to suffer with people. And I, Sharita, you've talked about like sitting with the suffering and like holding that tension and resisting the ego and the prideful piece that I think comes in modern day ministry, that you can't just sit as a source of comfort and presence. You have to fix it. You have to have some ridiculous Christian catchphrase that's going to change the perspective and alter someone's activity in that moment and like supercharge them into this space of healing and getting past things.
Because your degree of faith is connected to how you suffer, how long you suffer, when you come out of suffering, what kind of suffering you have. 100%. And so if you can't, if you're in it too long, that's not okay. Like grief, you know, grief. If you're grieving for too long, that's then against God's will. If you are sick for too long, you haven't let go of something. Like, you should have been healed by now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Suffering is so uncomfortable. And I feel like that's a very Western world. And I may be wrong about that, but I know, like, growing up in America and in the church, it's a very, like, if you're suffering, I'm uncomfortable unless I can do something that, like, progresses that. Yeah, like, so I'm gonna bring you coffee and I can give you medicine or whatever, and then, like, you're better, right? Like, let's continue on in this space. Instead of, like, culturally and, like, humanity-wise, like, sitting with suffering, it does not have a timeline. And, like, again, it goes back to that community piece, and it's biblical too. Like, when people would pass away in the Bible, they would have people that would, like, those public mourners, those professional mourners, like, they would rip their clothes and they would scream and they would cry, and it provided a sense of solidarity to that family so that they felt like they could sit in their own grief and their own timeline. And there's a lot of cultures where, like, when grief, when something happens, there is, like, these extended periods of of time. I know there's countries that will give you, like, months off after a death or months off when you're sick so that you can rest and recover and heal. There's a lot of ceremonies that, like, honor the suffering and honor the experience. And I feel like we're very dismissive in that of, like, okay, action-based, let me do something. And then it's like, okay, that's better. Like,
right. I wrote about that concept a little bit when I wrote God of the Gaps. And one of the things that I talked about was, like, resisting the desire to keep your suffering in scorecards and, like, comparing someone's suffering to someone else's, because that's the other weird toxic...
Oppression Olympics.
Yes, like, that happens in a lot of faith spaces of, like, well, I don't want to share my suffering because they're suffering more, or, like, I have this huge suffering. How dare you talk about this little... Like, it feels like this weird comparison game that is so incredibly toxic. And I think it's important to remember, like, there is no scorecard in suffering. Like, your suffering is unique to you. And if it makes your life hard and uncomfortable and creates a sense of dysregulation, it's valid and it's important. And it doesn't ever have to feel like, oh, I don't know that this is a big deal. And I think there's a lot of places where that ties into conversations I've had with people in faith of, like, well, this isn't a big deal. I don't want to bother God with this. I don't want to pray about this. I don't want to tell other people about this. This is small. I should be able to handle that.
I want so badly to take this in another direction, but I know you had another side that you wanted to take us down. But I'm listening to all of this, and I'm seeing a connection between suffering and prosperity gospel. The idea that suffering is anti-God's will. Like, for me, I think we should be normalizing suffering as a part of the fallen world that we live in. Like, suffering is a part of living. Just like, you know, like, up is the opposite of down. Like, you can't have, you know, great joy without also having great sorrow. It's a part of the lived experience of the human experience.
Yeah.
And this idea that we should not suffer as Christians is very much tied to the prosperity gospel, that as a believer, we should not have to suffer any longer.
Yeah. I read about that too in God of the Gaps, because that was me. Like, I remember being in a season of suffering where my mentality at the beginning of that, which was the circumstance that precipitated that book, and so I talk about that very honestly, where I said, like, I remember thinking, how dare you make me suffer this? I don't deserve this.
Like, I'm going to church. I'm tithing. I'm involved in a small group. Like, I'm a good person. I don't deserve to suffer. And that mentality was so ingrained in me that it took a long time to process that and deconstruct that and recognize, like you just said, Sherita, suffering is innate to the human experience, and it doesn't devalue who we are, nor does it diminish our faith. Like, faith and suffering can coexist.
Absolutely. And what Holly said made me think about it is, you know, this question of, is this more of an American Western thing? I think we are definitely caught up in it more than other places because of freaking capitalism. You know, this idea that, you know, we're rich and we're wealthy and because your wealth helps you to not suffer. And, you know, it makes me sick.
Yeah. So here's the other place I wanted to go with that, which I think connects really well, Sherita, with where you were saying, and I think will kind of bring us full circle on this conversation, and that is how many instances of suffering being mishandled theologically and being dismissed in the church, or being misunderstood from a faith perspective lead to religious trauma and lead to crisis of faith or an abandonment of faith. I have a person in my life who I love very, very deeply, and they have walked away from a faith relationship with God for quite some time now, and it's a direct result of being in suffering, and it is a direct result of several things that happened in that suffering. One of them is that they would constantly pray that their suffering would cease. And that suffering did not miraculously cease in the timeline that they wanted and expected. So doubt crept in that said, why am I praying? Is there anybody actually, like, what is this? I'm not sure that this is a real thing anymore. So, like, that doubt was there. But then I think in a doubtful heart that was struggling and suffering through this immense trauma, they kept encountering Christians and faith spaces that would say, oh, but you're going to have an amazing story to tell one day. Or, you know, wow, God must really have big plans for you because he's strengthening you in all of these. And so, like, there was a very individual religious trauma that was ongoing from their personal private prayer life, but there was also this corporate trauma that was happening that eventually just said, I don't want anything to do with it. I don't think God's real. I want nothing to do with the church. And like just this complete rupture of community and connection that happened in that space. And I don't think the church, again, wants to be held accountable for the trauma that gets inflicted. So we talk about all of these people who've left the church, and we talk about them oftentimes, and evangelical spaces talk about them in ways of like, oh, they've backslidden. They're such horrible people. They don't want to be in the church.
You created trauma and suffering in their life, and they left because they were in pain.
Well, and because they were suffering because of systems and structures and injustices, and you refuse to acknowledge their suffering. You kept dismissing it, right? Like all the different pieces of that I think are really important to also name.
I mean, I think it goes back to that place of that accountability and some of those action pieces, like to say that, oh, like you're going through this for a reason. Because I had that said to me a lot. I also just like absorbed that a lot growing up without like, because it was so, some of the things I dealt with was so private. And so like absorbing that from just like things that people would say to me of like, there's purpose in your suffering. And I struggle so much going back to like some of those deserved pieces. Cause like when, you know, right now we are just, you know, the genocide in Gaza that's happening right now, like you think of babies that are being born into that in those tents, like does that child deserve to suffer that way? No, like I want to believe that every human on this planet would look at a tiny newborn and say, no, they don't deserve that. But there's just this massive, again, this disconnection from that, this fear of natural disasters that is like, you know, that we don't have control over the world, and like we don't, but also natural disasters are increasing because we're not taking accountability for our own actions. And it kind of goes back to that place of like naming purpose, naming, you know, a great life someday, naming a closer relationship to God without taking those pieces of accountability is just so incredibly harmful. And I would venture to say that so many people, because I have so many friends and people that I love dearly who've walked away from church and who've walked away from God altogether because of suffering, that have this deep connection too, though. Like, it's not that they are so resentful that they're disconnected from suffering. In fact, the opposite is happening. I feel like there's so many people that are so much more connected to human suffering, to world suffering, because they experience the trauma of being abandoned or being dismissed or harmed in those places. And I know, I just feel like that should be a wake-up call, that sometimes the people that are loving better are the people that walked away from God and from the church.
So yesterday, I'm in my last semester at Eden Theological Seminary, graduation in May. Super excited with my doctorate in ministry. It's a great program. Highly recommend it. But I was sitting in class yesterday, and it was a class that I'm taking on public pastoral care. One of my favorite topics, favorite teacher. Like, it was a good way. It's going to be a good way to end the journey and the time there. But yesterday, Dr. Leslie, who's teaching this class, Kristen Leslie, shared this quote from Tracy West, and it has just like resonated in my spirit for the last 24 hours. And I want to share it with you because, Holly, what you said reminded me of it. And so the quote is, "The most vulnerable are the moral center of our world." Mm. And I think it goes back to like what we've talked about here many times. Like, what does that look like to redefine success? Not by the lifestyle of the richest and most powerful, but to define success by the quality of life of the most vulnerable, the most marginalized. And so I think there's this call and accountability piece of suffering that says those that are suffering are the moral center. Those that are suffering the most should be the place where the church is like gravitating to as a source of comfort, not as like a, let me come in and preach at you, let me come in and like just try to fix these things. But also, those should be the moral centers that draw our voice. Like, you were naming some of those places, Holly, of like children that are suffering in Gaza and, you know, environmentalism and the impact of that in the world. And when we see suffering and we don't speak up about it, and we don't speak truth, and we don't call out power in those spaces, I think there's a question of the moral center of the church that has to be raised, that says when we are more accountable to power, privilege, and gain than we are to suffering and vulnerability, I think that's really concerning. I think the last thing I just want to kind of touch on before we close this podcast out is, for those of you that are listening that are faith leaders, I want to challenge you that doesn't mean we don't talk about suffering, right? Mm-hmm. That means we talk about suffering in a trauma-informed way. That means that we talk about suffering as a call to community and relationship. That means that we're not afraid to name and bring in hard topics and current events and things like mental illness into the pulpit and talk about those things and unpackage those things and help people to process those in a way that doesn't make people feel like they have to be isolated when they're suffering or when they're struggling. And in a way that says, like, let's deconstruct these things that we've all carried individually and generationally together, because the toxicity that they've created in our faith systems, in our churches, in our communities, in our lives, in our marriages has to be named and has to be called out. And so to me, I think there's beautiful opportunity for healing that exists in churches to change the tone of these conversations. And, you know, like you said, Sharita, suffering's inevitable. It's part of the human experience. And so I think it's really critical that we support and find ways to teach faith leaders how to approach that conversation completely differently.
And that's the piece that I would like to highlight as we close, is that I think we need to learn and relearn how to be with others through suffering.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, that piece of, like, we also need to, like, normalize that it's okay not to not know what to do, or it's okay to not be able to fix it. Like, you can't always fix suffering. And from a church perspective, from a leader perspective, being able to normalize, like, but we just sit with people and we acknowledge it and we ask how we can help and we find little ways to meet practical needs
we
to
support,
help.
Not necessarily fix. We support, yes. We sit with, we love, we lament.
Yeah.
Lament is kind of a collective action.
Yeah. And it's a scriptural collective action that I think we've often replaced with,
mm-hmm.
let me do something, let me just make it better.
Yeah. If you'll let me, I'm going to end with a tree analogy, but it's just because, like, it's all I keep seeing while we're talking is how much suffering shapes us as a people, as a human, as an individual, and as a culture, and as a human, like, population of species. And I think of how often, like, suffering is so dismissed that it's so private that it becomes something that, like, it changes us, but we don't show the world that change. And change is actually really beautiful, and change is actually just, like, a natural part of existence. And, like, we are who we are because of what we've been through, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever, like, seen a tree when it is cut down, especially when it has been cut down by humans, because it's usually a very, very clean cut, and you can see, like, the rings of a tree. If that tree never experienced suffering, that tree, those rings would be perfect. There would be no shift at all in those rings. But because the trees experience suffering, because the world experiences suffering, it's not just humans, it's the world, there is changes. And you'll see spots in the tree where, you know, that they didn't have that much water, so the rings are smaller, or it was an abundant year, so the rings are much bigger. There'll be marks where, like, there was a fire, and trees that survive fires, and you can see the burn marks, you can see the holes where there was illness, you can see the injuries of a tree. Even when you look at a tree that is still growing, you can see all the different, I love seeing trees that have, like, they're, like, twisted, and, like, they'll be, like, bent over, and you're like, I wonder what happened to you. Like, the fact that you kept growing despite the fact that you have this perfect bend in you, or despite the fact that you have this curve, and just, like, the resilience. And I say resilience because I hate the word, the way we use resilience, but I believe that resilience is a really beautiful word when you think about it, like, that I will keep going despite these things, but I'm going to show it, and I'm going to live it, and I'm going to let it change me for good. And so I think that that's just a really beautiful visualization of how we should live.
Yeah, your visualization makes me think of epigenetics.
Mm.
How we store this trauma, and it changes us at the cellular level, and how, mm-hmm. in spite of some of those cellular level changes, we continue to grow and experience life. Either in a healthy way or in an unhealthy way. And it's dependent on the external environment in addition to what's happened to us internally. Mm-hmm. And part of that external environment includes the people in our lives, our connections, our community, and the people who we share life with. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I am grateful to share life with both of you. I am grateful to share suffering with both of you, and seasons of transition and change and all the tension that's embedded in all of that right now in our worlds. Thank you for creating safe space and soft space for us to process hard things. I hope that this is helpful for those of you that are listening. I know it was helpful for me. I hope it was helpful for the two of you too. We will be back next week. I do want to say quickly, as we're closing out, you will notice that this is our second week in a row where we are missing Rue's voice. Rue's going to be taking a bit of a break from the podcast for a while, and they will be back. And when they are back, they will share some of their story with you. So we just wanted to kind of frame that. You may hear a couple of new voices that will be joining us on and off through the next few weeks. So we're excited to introduce you to some new friends and invite some new people around this table. Phil is going to still be with us from time to time. His schedule is a little different right now than it has been in the past, so you may not hear him quite as consistently as you have in the past, but we love him and celebrate the opportunities that our schedules sync up perfectly that he can be around this table too. So just wanted to share that little update with you related to to Flip Table, and we will be back again next week with another conversation. So we'll talk to you soon.